Thank you, Marcia. Thank you to all of our panelists. We'll now invite questions. We have 20, 25 minutes for discussion. So please feel free to approach the microphone.
Yes, on the topic of reconciliation first in Australia, how can one reconcile, first of all, the fact that many of the tribal lands in Australia are fantastic tourist destinations and deliver a tremendous impact upon the Australian gross domestic product? How can one reconcile that with the fact that these heritage lands really should not be trespassed, should not... There is damage done to the indigenous population when tourists come and visit these, and yet it's a beautiful thing to show to from people all across the world. So that's an issue of reconciliation. There's no extra truth that can be discovered here, at least not on the surface, but that issue, that's an issue of reconciliation, and I know there are differing opinions among the indigenous community. I was wondering how that can be handled in a proper way. The second question I have is about the question of the government of Perez Molina. How can we have true reconciliation, and what steps? You know, we can't even speak about, we can speak about some truth, but how can we even ponder reconciliation when such an individual from the military dictatorship is in power in that country? And how far ahead, how many years do we have to look forward until we can probably take the next step forward? Thank you.
Okay, just to your point about, I guess what I was saying, that reconciliation in Australia is about educating the broader population about the importance of our traditional culture, our history and our lands. And the other side of that is, though, and I think which Andrew drew on yesterday, is the self-determination aspect, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities need to be in a power and a position to determine who comes and goes on their lands and how they develop those lands for their own economic and social viability. So, I mean, whilst I focus and we focus on our role in terms of educating the broader population, building a sense of respect and relationship, there is the other side of the coin, which is about how do we create self-determination and empower decision-making back into Aboriginal communities. So, I mean, that's how we, I guess, would try to describe about the process. And it's not a complete process and it's not a silver bullet, as I said, and it's not it's a more holistic process that you actually have to look at all those aspects.
The question about Otto Perez Molina and ex-Kaibil. The Kaibiles are the most famous within the Guatemalan Army security force that they're very proud of. And throughout Latin America, those who want to join the army in their countries look forward to join the Kaibiles in Guatemala. And Otto Perez Molina's Kaibiles are today part of the United Nations peacekeeping operations in many countries. And that should be a big outcry and protest to the United Nations, because I think it's just a violation of their own protocol not to hire peacekeeping operations that have been involved in genocidal or mass atrocities. A lot of people talk about remilitarization of Guatemala. No, there was never a demilitarization. As I said, the peace accords demobilized the civil patrols. But again, as I said, at the same time that they were being demobilized, they were told by the army, you are our country's heroes. So the first president after the peace accords was the party of General Efrain Rios Montt. And we were stunned. I remember, you know, being in Guatemala, and I was part of the election process. I was part of the organization OAS, Organization of American States, as an electoral observer. And we were stunned to think that how come the general who committed the genocide is being now elected? And everyone thought, and I thought, it's fear. So, but then, because I went back to Chichi, because I stayed in the country after the Truth Commission, I began to realize that the generals, all the generals, the army has a lot of support. It's very sad, but the army has support within indigenous populations.
Could I add to that, Marcia? Is this working? Recently, Helen Mack, one of the most well-known human rights defenders in Guatemala, came out with a public statement, an editorial, in which she said, she asked the international community to please not forget the ongoing human rights violations while they deal with the past violations. And at the moment, there's a separation of these two that's quite stark. And her point was that the underlying causes are very much related, and this has a lot to do with the points that you raised about demilitarization. A failure to look at the current violations results in people like Perez Molina or Rios Montt being elected largely on a security platform, a public security platform, and mano dura, as they say.
As a Guatemalan, I got to learn that the word reconciliation for my home country is something that remains a very strange concept to the reality of Guatemala. And I was always following the reports that you mentioned, the Truth Commission by the United Nations, the report by the Catholic Church that was presented by Monsignor Gerardi, assassinated 2 days after he presented his report in the National Cathedral in Guatemala City in 1998. And recently the trial on the genocide for General Rios Montt. And one of the things that I always wonder about is what happens to the people who give their testimonies in Guatemala? What happened to the people who you interviewed, the people who were interviewed by the Catholic Church, the people who went to the trial, to the court in Guatemala City? What's going on there?
What I know, well, you see, remember when the peace accords were signed, there was this euphoria, you know, there was this energy in Guatemala that the peace accords were ending this bloody war and things were going to get better. You know, that was the beginning of transitional justice. Transitional justice as a paradigm didn't exist before. It was beginning. You know, it was the beginning of transitional justice. So there was this sense of moving forward, and everyone was caught up, you know, on that. So I think that that climate prevented or somehow gave witnesses some security, I think. We don't have reports that witnesses to the Truth Commission had been killed or they were threatened. For, of course, the civil patrols were still their own, even family members. So people were still intimidated, harassed, etc. Now, with the trial against ex-general Rios Montt, I have reports that witnesses who came forward in the trial are being intimidated in their community. So we're doing a big thing. I think it's going to be May 10. That we want to connect with all kind of human rights organizations in Canada, all over the world, and demand security for the victims. Because, you know, a lot of people are up in arms because the fiscal, the general attorney, Claudia Paz y Paz, is being forced to be removed. She's being removed from her post before her tenure is up. What about the witnesses? Yeah, that's for me, that's the biggest concern, because people like the general, you know, like Claudia Paz y Paz, who is the lawyer, she has a lot of international attention. But what about the women and all these people that, you know, were brought from the mountains in buses and then went back to their communities? The civil patrols, they know who went to testify. They're their neighbors. So I urge you to please check out our website. And take action. You know, this is about civil society, the international community, lending and not forgetting. We don't forget, and we don't forgive either. As a project, we don't forget and we don't forgive.
First of all, let me thank you all for compelling arguments and presentations. A question for Ms. Redford. Your considered view at your commission's considered view now is that you have to emphasize together rather than apart. And at one point you said, I believe, if I heard you, that none of us acknowledge our roles. My question is, how essential is acknowledgement? I understand the importance of people coming to terms with their own experiences and to some degree their own guilt. But guilt itself can be a divisive factor, and there are other forces that cause people to come together than guilt. And I wonder if that was if that reference to acknowledgement of our roles, by which I think you meant acknowledgement of our guilt, is something which you consider to be essential or potentially problematic for the process of reconciliation. And while that comment was based upon your observation, it may well also apply in the situation of Australia, where there are some quite direct parallels to challenges that we face.
Thank you for your question. I think that acknowledgement at this time in Northern Ireland, or the north of Ireland, to go back to that, again, problematic phrase, is that we're on a sort of continuum. There's those who feel that perhaps acknowledgement comes somewhere in the middle of that, where those who are not quite yet ready to recognize that they are in a position at some stage to own the experiences that they've been part of, are certainly in a position to recognize that as we seek a shared future, so too we seek the commonalities in our past. So acknowledgement is less problematic a word for us, I suppose, in terms than reconciliation. And we could, we can play semantics all day long, I suppose, but acknowledgement provides us, I think, with a creativity to be able to recognize one another's and our own reflexive processes in there. Thank you for the suggestion that it may well fit with Australia. I think, it feels comfortable to me to use that word at the moment, and it's certainly something that on the sort of truth, justice, acknowledgement and guilt continuum, it sits there and is doable at this stage. It enables us to work together with people to recognize different kinds of programming that don't put and box people into positions that they're not yet ready to take, but certainly give them a platform from which to start.
Absolutely. Acknowledgement is very central to reconciliation in Australia, even from the point of acknowledging traditional owners of land, and it's something that we, throughout our education process, as a beginning to understand our history and obviously the 50,000 year sort of history that we have in Australia, acknowledging that is fundamental to start as a starting process for reconciliation. I mean, certainly there has also been, on the flip side, the times when obviously people would not acknowledge what has happened in Australia's development. But we see a lot more, and certainly through what I didn't talk about, the program, other program areas that we focus on in schools and education, about creating the correct curriculum about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander history and our cultures in the schools program. And we have a process at the moment in Australia through the revision of the Australian curriculum, which is a new nationwide curriculum, and one of the four cross-priority curriculums across that will be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture and history, and that will be cross-curriculum in maths, English, geography, science and history across all those, and it becomes mandatory. So, I mean, that is a process of starting to acknowledge our history, our shared history it's not, we don't shy away from acknowledgement. And in fact, as part of our process, that acknowledgement of traditional owners, of elders, is something we get lots of corporate leaders to do in terms of, part of their understanding of the history to do to their employees, to open their meetings in that way to show that they are on a journey as well.
I was wondering, why does colonialism impact on civil society? Well, I want to believe in reconciliation, but I sort of am hearing that, there's a relationship between colonialism and civil society, and I'm not really sure what that relationship is and, why. And how does that affect reconciliation?
I want...
Well, one of the ways that you could see that the relationship is through the lens of the communities from Chichicastenango who didn't come forward to testify. There is a post-colonial relationship there of the oppressed that remains linked to their own oppressors. And so this very complicated and complex relationship is rooted in colonial times. So because colonization, one of the main instruments of colonization is the army, is military force. Right? And so it was the army and this alliance as the amigos of the army, the friends of the army, that people didn't come forward to that pockets of civil society are prevented from being organized. The army prevents people from organizing. And in the many testimonies that I took after the Truth Commission, when I went back to the highlands, people would say to me, the good peasant is the peasant that doesn't get organized. Those were the army's amigos. On the other side, the people were saying, all the army does here is que nos chinga. How could you translate chingar? They bother us, right? So on the side of the civil society who are organized, the army for them is a pain in the neck. For the other side, the army is their authority figure. The army, I mean, people, those are the ones who vote for Pérez Molina. Those are the ones who really believe that the army, what they did, was in the best interest. Because during the war, the psychological campaign, the war campaigns, the army deployed part of the counterinsurgency campaigns. Of course, it was the killing of people, the physical, the massacres. But it was also the psychological campaigns telling peasants, join the army, united, we will defeat the internal enemy. So that's a relationship that people, pockets of civil society, remain tied to the army and therefore are prevented, not only because they want to keep silence over the criminal crimes, but also because they owe loyalty to the army. And that's a post-colonial relationship. I don't know.
I think in the case of Ireland and in the north of Ireland, what's happened is that post-colonialism gave a lack of equity and equality in terms of structural services that were available to certain members of the community. And that, in turn, provided an opportunity for people to mobilize and develop a very strong third sector, which in turn developed an opportunity for advocacy and movement and further democratic developments. So it's worked hand in glove with post-colonialism at some level, in that it's now enabling new forms of governance to develop themselves.
And I guess from the Australian perspective, when I sort of spoke earlier in terms of the reconciliation movement really is rooted in that sort of, colonialism when Australia was first discovered, in that, the British had, believed the land belonged to no one and that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders were inferior. Therefore, the whole development of Australia was based on a superior race over an inferior race. And also, it wasn't until the 1967 referendum when, because of civil society, that we actually got the most successful referendum Australia has had in its history, which allowed the government to make laws on behalf of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but also to have us recognised in the national census and be counted as citizens of Australia. Prior to that referendum, we were recognised under the Flora and Fauna Act. So we're not talking about colonialism as in, when we first discovered. This is, quite recent, and, those of us who are of that age, who are around that, would have been born and not actually recognised as citizens and be classed under the Flora and Fauna Act. So it's continuing effects of colonialism are still repeated today.
Thank you to all the panellists for your discussion. It was really, really interesting and fascinating. I have a question for all of you, and this is specifically dealing with morally negative abstract, the divisive aspects of Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So in all of your speeches today, you've discussed a lot of the positive impact, either through personal or through third-party involvement with organizations in Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but also at the same time, it's a deeply divisive issues and can bring a lot of animosity between the, say, the state and the society, and sometimes to the point of unnecessarily, especially in a fragile phase when the state is trying to rebuild from a post-conflict scenario. So I'm wondering, in your experiences, how have these divisive issues arise in these constructions, especially for Ms. Esperanza in a relatively fragile stages of state building, or compared to, say, the more develop or supposed mature societies where there's already a lot of mechanisms for status, for discussions and constructive discourse, and what mechanisms have you employed either through third-party NGOs, nonprofits, or state mechanisms to ensure that these divisive issues are turned into constructive issues? Thank you.
To answer just very briefly, because you gave me an opportunity to say something about this notion of fragile and weak states. I don't buy it. I think characterizing the state in Guatemala, I would characterize this as an authoritarian state, a strong state. It's a strong state in the rural areas. When you go to Guatemala, I hope you visit Guatemala and go to Chichicastenango, you will see three trucks in the rural areas. The army's trucks, Coca-Cola, and the beer, Gallo. The relationship between indigenous groups in the mountains with the state is through the army. So the army is strong and has become even stronger over the years. And about the division, and if truth commissions are polarized even more societies, society like Guatemala underneath is so deeply polarized, is so deeply unequal, that really, yes, you know, the truth commission divides, you know, people, you know, those who are in favor, those who are against, etc. But it's already very deeply divided. I don't want you to think that, you know, because of the Truth Commission, the society is polarized. There is a deep polarization underneath the society.
I think for us, one of the challenges, not just the division between the state and non-state, it's between a variety of different groups, and intra-group tensions are still there in a variety of different ways. The biggest challenge for us is in terms of accountability. Were a truth commission to be put in place, there is absolutely no indication that either state or non-state combatants would engage in it in a way that was meaningful for those who could benefit most from that veracity process. So it remains a divisive issue for us at this time.
I'm not quite sure if this is going to answer your question, but I mean, there is always a fragility between the state and not-for-profit organisations because we mainly get funded by them. And a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations as well, and are funded by government. I mean, the government have been the primary sponsors of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander advancement. But one of the things which I didn't talk about in depth today, just due to time, is in terms of accountability, I think, which you raised, is that at post the 2008 apology, the government put in place six priority targets on closing the gap in Indigenous disadvantage. And these are national ambitions by the Council for Australian Governments to monitor the progress of addressing six priorities. Those being, you know, to close the gap in life expectancy by 2031, to halve the gap in infant mortality rates, to close the gap in numeracy, literacy, reading for Aboriginal students, and to halve the gap in Aboriginal employment. And these targets have become such a focus point and mandate throughout sort of the whole sort of reconciliation lexicon, the language, that the civil society have grasped on and sort of hold, in some ways, try to hold the government accountable to those targets. They also, though, when the government has in fact, this government has continued the act of presenting a report to Parliament at the beginning of opening of Parliament each year on how they are progressing towards those gaps, closing those gaps. And however, we do have the alternate report, which is done by a couple of civil society organisations, not-for-profit, Oxfam, and, you know, a couple of the peak international organisations. But we also have the Productivity Commission in Australia, who also does a report on overcoming Indigenous disadvantage to also kind of keep the government accountable as well in terms of those targets. So I'm not sure if that quite answers your question. But
thank you.
Thanks.
I think we have time for one last question. This gentleman has been waiting for some time. Please.
Thank you. This was quite a comprehensive global event, and I'm really impressed. I'm still concerned. Our Canadian government, as you know, in the Central America, there's been mining activities, and like I'll give you an example, Goldcorp, I think is Guatemala, Panama. They've been threatening to just use their mining method, pollute the water that the people drink, and so they passed a bill. Honorable Joe will probably know about Bill C-300.
After my time.
Oh, yeah, it's after my time too. But it was a bill to, you know, get some sensibility here and civility in the Canadian mining companies going to other countries in the world. In fact, they go to the world, 90% of their activity is global because there's such strict laws in Canada, environmental laws, that they can't come here. Yet they're based still in Canada for financial reasons or whatever. So I'm just wondering, in an incident there, I know, it was in the papers, by the way, Guatemala, there was a guards hired by the company, and they raped the women and God knows what else, and it made the headlines in Canada. Now that's, I suggest that the second bill that's going to pass, by the way, the second reading of that bill, it was defeated by the government in the Republic of Canada, and it was, nobody said anything about it. And if there had been some global input there, and I think, you know, you somehow with lobbyists of somewhere for, it could be there. And as a result, you know, people would know, because there's another bill coming now in the government of Canada that in fact is going to appease the companies a little bit because they didn't like whose authority had what and the dictatorships and all that. It was very complicated. But I suggest that you look at the fact that Canada has a bill coming, and you should be making sure that it just doesn't die on the books like it did, three, 4 years ago. So especially I'd like to get your comments, Marcia, because it was in your part of the world.
Well, about, yes, I mean, you're just, you know, giving even more evidence to the need to be very active, civil society in lobbying in favor of laws that will constrain, I don't know, restrict, right, or will impose some mechanisms by which, you know, these Canadian companies or, you know, other companies, there are also some Latin American companies, you know, that are going into Guatemala and hiring these private security guards to quell, you know, dissent to these companies. And, I mean, it's business as usual, unfortunately. You know, I just spoke, you know, at the beginning of my presentation about the Rio Negro massacre, and there was a massacre. You know, when was that? The Totonicapan, like a year ago, there was another, you know, post-peace accords massacre. You are quite right to follow that it's very important to be very, I don't like this word very much, but vigilant on the Canadian government passing laws that will impact Indigenous peoples elsewhere, particularly Indigenous peoples in what is called the, you know, third world, or, you know, by now it's like the sixth world, or, you know, whatever, the global south, right? It can have an impact. I truly believe in the international community, because I have seen a change in the support of international community. Before, when wars were going on in Central America during the Cold War years, there was a big, you know, uproar and outcry, you know, by different groups internationally. But then the peace accords came, the supposed transitional justice came, and you know, I don't see a lot of support, international support, pockets of support that are very valuable, but I think there should be more, especially coming from students who can, you know, this whole generation that can be taught, you know, taught that these things are happening on their name, on the name of progress, of Canadian progress or any other country's progress. I don't know if that comment makes sense for you, but we can talk more later. Thank you so much for your comment.
I could just quickly add, this relates to the session before lunch regarding the situation in South Africa, in the sense that the examples that you provided reflect both the failure of the earlier 1996-97 truth process to lead to the kind of transformation that was hoped for, but also, as Professor Deisenhaus points out, it reflects the resilience of civil society in Guatemala, which has continued to work and push for change. And good examples of that are the fact that, specifically the case you mentioned of the killings and rape in Guatemala, a court in Toronto will hear that case eventually due to a civil claim that's being made. And on the 4th of April, a criminal trial will begin in Guatemala related to that case, just to provide an example of, again, the resilience of civil society and the work that it's doing. Unfortunately, we don't have time to continue the discussion. We could go on for some time, but I just want to thank the panelists and thank the organizers of the event for a very important discussion. I think it advanced the conversation that began yesterday and continues, and so we look forward to the next session. But please join me in thanking the panelists for their contribution.